And Abbott said the disproportionate use of force is discriminatory. Police forces in Britain have been required to keep a detailed record of each time an officer used force since April 1, 2017. According to the data, a black person in London is four times likely than a white person to have force used against them by a Met Police officer as a proportion of the population. London's black population at the last census was 1,088,447. In 2017 to 2018, the Met used force 22,989 times against black people. Based on population figures, the use of force was equivalent to once for every 50 black people in Greater London and once for every 200 of the white population. This is higher than in other police forces covering large urban areas such as Greater Manchester and Merseyside.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 2-4 of Surah Nahl, recited by Murtaza Rahnema.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Yunazzilul malaa'ikata bir-ruhi min amrihi 'ala man yasha'u min 'ibadihi أن أنذروا أنه لا إله إلا يتقون خلق السماوات والأرض بالحق تعالى عما يشركون خلق الإنسان من فإذا هو خصيم مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. He sends down the angels with inspiration by his commandment, on whom he pleases of his servants, saying, "Give the warning that there is no God but me. Therefore, be careful of your duty to me." He created the heavens and the earth with the truth. Highly exalted be he above what they associate with him. He created man from a small seed, and lo, he is an open contender.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran says the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA cannot be used as a basis for Tehran's cooperation with IAEA since the Western parties to the pact don't adhere to it. Authorities in Bangladesh launched an investigation into a massive fire in a Rohingya refugee camp that left around 12,000 of the Muslims without shelter. And dozens of Israeli Air Force reservists canceled a training day in protest at the so-called judicial reforms proposed in the regime's far-right cabinet. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Iran complies with its safeguards agreements with the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as the Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT. That's according to the country's head of the Atomic Energy Organization. Mohammad Islami made the remark one day after the Director General of the IAEA paid a two-day visit to Tehran. Islami noted that the UN nuclear watchdog's inspections of Iran's nuclear activities must be conducted in accordance with a law enacted by Iran's parliament. The legislation titled Strategic Action Plan was passed in 2020 to counter sanctions and develop the country's nuclear program. Islami also talked about obligations under the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA, which was torpedoed after Washington withdrew from it. He underlined that the accord cannot be used as a basis for Iran's cooperation with the IAEA since the Western parties to the pact don't adhere to it. Meanwhile, Islami rejected allegations that Iran has exceeded its declared 60% uranium enrichment. He said the issue has now been settled with IAEA.
The stalemate between Tehran and the three remaining signatories to the Iran deal over reviving the 2015 landmark agreement has once again brought the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, to the Iranian capital. Rafael Grossi held talks with a number of Iranian officials, including President Ebrahim Raisi, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. During a joint press conference with Iran nuclear chief, Grossi said his meetings in Iran took place in an atmosphere of cooperation.
The atmosphere is an atmosphere of work, of honesty and cooperation, and I think this is This, for me, it is the most important thing. Our dialogue will continue today.
The IEA chief also expressed hope that his meetings with Iranian officials would produce good results.
We are working hard. What I can tell you is that our teams, we have been working. Now we are taking recess to come and talk to you. But we are working hard in order to have good solutions today.
He also hailed his meetings with Iranian authorities as constructive.
By having a constructive discussion like we are having now and having good agreements like I am sure we are going to have, we are going to be paving the way for important agreements. And this is my hope.
Iran atomic chief also addressed the reporters. Aslami said the Islamic Republic has no reservation about advancing its nuclear program, adding that the country will not give up on its national interests. Regarding claims about uranium enrichment, Aslami said the IAEA's report has confirmed Iran has not enriched uranium beyond its declared 60%. He added the issue has now been resolved between the two sides. Aslami underlined that the meetings show Tehran and the IAEA maintain professional relationship.
The visit by the head of the IAEA comes as the UN agency is accused of bias when it comes to Iran's nuclear program. Tehran is critical of the agency's political approach and says the UN watchdog is under the influence of Israel, which is not even a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
The recent visit by the IAEA chief to Iran comes as many throughout the world have raised doubts over the impartiality of the UN agency. This comes to the spotlight, especially when the UN nuclear watchdog has always failed to address questions about the agency's inspection of Israeli nuclear sites. During his press conference, Grossi argued that Israel is not a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, and therefore the agency cannot technically inspect Israeli sites. Given that, one would argue that the IAEA, along with the international community, have failed to pressure the Israeli regime to become a member of the agreement. After all, the regime in Tel Aviv possesses more than 400 nuclear warheads, which can by default be an enormous threat to the entire world. In the meantime, Iran has been critical of the UN agency for acting politically in cases related to the technical issues of the country's nuclear program. Tehran says the agency acts under the influence of certain countries, but the IAEA claims otherwise.
The IAEA has not been and will never be a political tool of anybody. I, as Director General, I am independent. I am under no country's instructions.
Iran's concern can be clearly felt in President Ebrahim Raisi's remarks when he met with Rafael Grossi on Saturday. President Raisi said Tehran will continue to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency if the IAEA preserves its independence and defend the rights of the Iranian people. Raisi said Tehran expects the agency's activities not to be under the influence of certain world powers who pursue their personal interests. The president called on the IAEA to express realities about Iran's nuclear program without any partiality and based on professional behavior. This is significantly debatable when one argues that the International Atomic Energy Agency has even failed to condemn terrorist attacks on Iranian nuclear sites as well as those targeting Iranian scientists. This is why the pressure is always coming from entities like Israel that are not even a party to the NPT. The pressure is also coming from countries like the United States that they themselves are in possession of hundreds or maybe thousands of nuclear warheads and a threat to humanity by nature.
Iran and Afghanistan have opened a joint permanent commercial center in Kabul. The venture brings together traders and investors from both countries to boost trade. Our correspondent Abdullah Amirzadeh reports.
Iran-Afghanistan Permanent Trade Center has been opened in the capital, Kabul. The center is in line with the two countries' policies of expanding bilateral ties and connecting business people of the two neighboring states. During the opening ceremony, Afghanistan's Minister of Industry and Commerce highlighted the country's expectations about trade between the two countries.
We expect to balance the trade with Iran. We want to export our goods to Iran, which enjoys a good market. Iran's export to Afghanistan is more than $2 billion a year. But I won't mention our export to Iran because it's a very small amount. We hope that Tehran modifies its laws so that we can increase our exports.
With the opening of this center in Kabul and its capabilities, it is believed that the Taliban government in Afghanistan is providing a platform for more economic connections between Tehran and Kabul.
This center is an example of good relations between Afghanistan and Iran. Both countries have a lot of potentials, and with the opening of this center, we hope that bilateral trade gets a big boost and Tehran and Kabul can be great partners.
This center has great capabilities which can have great effects on rebuilding Afghanistan and the war-torn country's infrastructure.
The priorities for this center are trade of industries, equipment and machineries, also food industry, mining industry and technology. We are also ready to set up an iron production line in Afghanistan. On the other side, mines and precious stones here are useful for Iran.
Iranian and Afghan officials hope that the center helps advance the export goals of the two countries. They highlighted that the development of sustainable trade and exports is the most important task of this center in Kabul.
Many believe the opening of such trade centers would have positive effects on Afghanistan's economy that has taken a lot of damage due to years of political and financial instability. Dulai Mirzadeh, Kabul.
A massive fire rips through a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh, robbing around 12,000 people of their shelter. Flames swept through the Kutub Palong camp and gutted some 2,000 huts before it was brought under control. 90 facilities, including hospitals and schools, were burnt down as a result. Bangladeshi authorities are yet to release the number of casualties. They say an investigation is underway to determine the cause of the fire. An estimated 1 million Rohingya Muslims live in the world's largest refugee camp in Bangladesh. They escaped to Bangladesh in 2017 after genocide by the military in their homeland, Myanmar. Anger continues to flare up in Israel over judicial reforms proposed by the new far-right cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now dozens of Air Force reservists say that they will not turn up for a training day in protest. In a letter circulated in local media, 37 pilots and navigators from an F-15 squadron said they would skip drills scheduled for Wednesday. This comes amid weeks-long demonstrations against Netanyahu's policies. Some protest leaders, among them former military chiefs, say Tel Aviv's policies could lead to mass disobedience within the ranks. The regime seeks changes that include curbs on the Supreme Court, which it accuses of overreach. Critics say Netanyahu wants excessive power over the judiciary. He is already on trial on graft charges. Meanwhile, Iran says it has recently been targeted by an intensifying media campaign to deflect attention from the unrest and internal crisis plaguing the Israeli regime. The top U.S. general has paid a visit to one of the country's bases in Syria. Damascus has slammed the move as illegal and a flagrant violation of Syria's sovereignty. Earlier, we delved deeper into the issue in our news review program. Let's see what our guests had to say.
It's news review time. Damascus has condemned a visit by the top U.S. general to an American base in northeast Syria. The Syrian Foreign Ministry says the visit is illegal and a flagrant violation of the country's sovereignty. On Saturday, the U.S. Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, made an unannounced visit to assess the nearly eight-year mission there. Washington has stationed force and equipment in northeast of Syria without the consent of Damascus. The Pentagon claims it's fighting Daesh terrorists there. Damascus says that the illegal deployment is tantamount to occupation and aimed at supporting terrorists and plundering Syria's natural resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in the Arab country for its oil wealth. Let me invite a couple of guests to see what's going on there. So our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, is joining me from Damascus, the Syrian capital. Ken Stone, who is with the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, is also joining me from Hamilton. So, Mohammed, beginning with you, tell us how the Damascus government and the Syrian people feel about this. The U.S. is not asked to go to Syria to, as they allege, try to fight Daesh terrorists. They admitted themselves that they were the people who created terrorist groups like Daesh and gave rise to them. So what are they doing there? Tell us about the reactions both on the part of government and the people in Syria.
Yes, exactly. What the U.S. is doing in Syria, it's occupying Syria, it's supporting terrorism, and it's going after its own interests and, of course, killing Syrian people. Now, the Syrian Foreign Ministry strongly condemned the visit of the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to northeast of Syria. This is an illegal visit, according to the Foreign Ministry, to an illegal U.S. Base in the country under the pretext of evaluating the U.S. Fight against Daesh. Now, the Foreign Ministry said that such claims are false and that the international community, the entire international community, knows that Daesh was made by U.S. intelligence, explaining further the statement of the Foreign Ministry that Daesh never attacked any U.S. base in Syria or any U.S. troops on Syrian soil, only attacked Syrian civilians, innocent civilians. The Foreign Ministry in a statement also said that the U.S. continues to provide support to terrorist groups in Syria and also to separatist militias, referring, of course, to the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces on the ground, with the aim of prolonging the terrorist war on Syria. The Foreign Ministry demanded the U.S. to stop its violations of Syria's sovereignty over here, and also called on the international community to condemn such actions by the U.S. And finally, the Foreign Ministry concluded by saying that such acts and actions by the United States will not prevent Syria from fighting terrorism and preserving its sovereignty, security, and stability.
All right, Ken Stone, you just heard Mohammed Ali talk about how the Syrians feel about U.S. boots on Syrian soil. So, General Mark Milley, going there, is he going there to see, I don't know, to maybe find better ways to secure the oil that the American forces are trying to get out, to smuggle out of Syria, or what? I mean, why should the U.S. be somewhere where they are not wanted, they are not asked for to do anything? What are they doing there?
The U.S. has two purposes in being in occupying the eastern third of Syria completely illegally, of course. And one purpose is to deny Syria the ability to undertake reconstruction, because the U.S. is plundering the oil and wheat resources so that Syria doesn't have the money to reconstruct itself after 12 long years of failed U.S. regime change war, which was supported by the U.S. allies, such as, unfortunately, Canada. That's reason one. Reason two is the U.S. officials have openly stated that they're occupying the eastern third of Syria in order to use that occupation as a bargaining chip in the final settlement over the end of the U.S. proxy war in Syria. So the U.S. is in there illegally. They know they're in there illegally, but they're staying there because they're using it for a foreign policy goal.
Okay, thank you so much. Mohammed Ali in Damascus, Syria. Ken Stone in Hamilton, Ontario.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues
fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willest, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Limelight. Almost everyone knows that the United States attempts to ban TikTok are not about security. Rather, Washington lawmakers have an aversion to anything coming out of China and attaining global success. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Global Times wrote in this regard, commenting on the U.S. government's recent ban on a Chinese firm's short video-sharing app, TikTok, a spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry slammed Washington for its Abuse of state power in unreasonably cracking down on businesses from other countries, suggesting the U.S. lack of confidence against a mobile app. Following a series of moves against TikTok, which is owned by Chinese tech firm ByteDance, the White House recently asked U.S. government agencies to get rid of the app from official devices and systems within 30 days, according to Reuters. The move follows a ban ordered by the U.S. Congress, which cited national security concerns in December 2022. U.S. lawmakers are also set to vote on a bill that would give U.S. President Joe Biden the authorities to ban the app from all U.S. devices, Reuters reported. Asked about the U.S. ban on TikTok at a press briefing in Beijing, Mao Ning, spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, said that as the world's number one power, the U.S. is actually so afraid of a mobile app that young people like and that is rather too unconfident. We firmly oppose the U.S. wrong practice of generalizing the concept of national security and abusing state power to unreasonably suppress companies from other countries, Mao said, urging the U.S. to respect fair competition principles and stop crackdowns on relevant companies. ByteDance did not comment on the bans as of press time, but its subsidiary TikTok said that so-called national security concerns raised by U.S. and other officials are fueled by misinformation. TikTok stressed its efforts to protect user data and privacy. The U.S. move comes as Canada and the EU impose similar bans. Canada recently issued a ban on TikTok on government-issued devices, with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau suggesting moves could be taken. Last week, the EU's two biggest policy-making bodies also banned the app on staff phones, notably despite their repeated citing of security concerns as the reason for the bans. Western officials have not made public any instances of security breaches involving TikTok. The company, which has been trying to convince U.S. and European officials that concerns over its security issues are misplaced, noted that such bans are misguided and based on fundamental misconceptions. The bans sparked some criticism and opposition within the West. Following the U.S. move and ahead of the U.S. House of Representatives' votes on a bill to ban TikTok on all U.S. devices, the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, one of the largest public interest law firms in the U.S., said it firmly opposes the bill. Congress must not censor entire platforms and strip Americans of their constitutional right to freedom of speech and expression. Whether we are discussing the news of the day, live streaming protests, or even watching cat videos, we have a right to use TikTok and other platforms to exchange our thoughts, ideas, and opinions with people around the country and around the world, said Gina Leventhal, Senior Policy Counsel at ACLU. The ACLU noted, citing a U.S. law, that the U.S. government can't ban a social media platform simply because the app is from a Chinese company. There are growing concerns among U.S. businesses, especially small businesses, which rely on TikTok to promote their products and services. Despite the politically motivated moves, it might be too difficult to ban the app entirely, analysts noted. The U.S. increasingly reckless hostility against China has and will continue to hurt its own interest, analysts say. Although the U.S. has been talking up a ban on TikTok and even trying to force the sale of TikTok to a U.S. business, TikTok was the most popular mobile app in the U.S. in 2022, with 99 million downloads, according to Statistica. In the EU, 125 million people come to TikTok every month, according to the company. The move against TikTok comes as the U.S., along with some of its allies, are stepping up the crackdown on Chinese firms amid their politically motivated containment strategy against China, analysts believe. Using security as a pretext, the U.S. has cracked down on Chinese companies, and this trend is only going to intensify. He Wen, a senior fellow at the Center for China and Globalization, told the Global Times recently. As tensions between China and the U.S. continues to deepen, it is necessary to conduct communication to manage the differences, if not address them, he said. U.S. officials have repeatedly spoken about resuming trade talks with Chinese officials. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said that the U.S. will resume economic talks with China at an appropriate time. Commenting on reports of Yellen hoping to visit China earlier this month, a spokesperson for the Chinese Commerce Ministry said that the Chinese side holds a welcome attitude toward Secretary Yellen's wish to visit China. Meanwhile, China Daily wrote in this regard, "The furor in the United States over so-called Chinese spying, sparked by the Joe Biden administration's botched response to an errant Chinese meteorological research balloon, has been given a new lease on life, with the White House giving government agencies 30 days to remove the Chinese video sharing app, TikTok, from all federal devices and systems, alleging that it poses national security risks. Canada, which always toes the U.S. line in its anti-China strategy, also announced it is banning TikTok from all government-issued mobile devices. Some U.S. agencies, including the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, and State, already have restrictions on the Chinese app in place, as Congress passed the No TikTok on Government Devices Act in December, which requires the social media app to be removed from the information technology of federal agencies. The ban does not apply to entities not associated with the federal government or to the millions of U.S. people who use the hugely popular app." While the Biden administration claims the ban is due to its intensifying scrutiny concern and data privacy, it is nothing more than an ideologically motivated move. It is another instance of the U.S. using national security as an excuse to abuse state power in its clampdown on Chinese high-tech companies. The ban, in addition to many other restrictions targeting China's high-tech sector, including advanced semiconductors, has been introduced based on the spurious claim that the popular app is being used by the Chinese government to manipulate and monitor its users while it gobbles up Americans' data to be used for their malign activities. There has been nothing to support this allegation except the anti-China hysteria of some U.S. politicians. It is the app's Chinese ownership that is the app's original sin. The ban in December was passed without any deliberation, and unfortunately, that approach has served as a blueprint for other world governments. As TikTok spokesperson Brooke Oberwetter said, describing the ban as being little more than political theater. The ban has also drawn criticism from within the U.S. Americans have a right to use TikTok and other platforms to exchange other thoughts, ideas and opinions with people around the country and the world. It said that the ban will limit Americans' political discussion, artistic expression, free exchange of ideas, and even prevent people from posting cute animal videos and memes. It is sad that despite the world becoming increasingly interdependent and interconnected economically, the ghost of McCarthyism still haunts the U.S., riding on the paranoia about anything related to China.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
And welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we will be discussing two major issues, the Iran-India trade ties and the freedom of two brothers from Guantanamo after 20 years. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Iran's trade with India crosses $2 billion, registering 59.57% rise compared to the previous year. And we shall also take a look at two Pakistani brothers reach home after spending 20 years at Guantanamo without charges.
Iran's trade with India has crossed the $2 billion mark. The Islamic Republic's total exports to India hit more than $600 million during the year 2022, registering a 63.09% rise compared to the corresponding period of the previous year. According to estimates, the potential capacity of Iran's exports to India is equivalent to $21 billion. Experts believe that facilitating trade between the two countries will lead to the development of the economics of both of the countries.
According to the recent figures released by the Indian Ministry of Commerce and Industries, the net worth of Iran's exports to India stood at $653 million in 2022. The figure was $409 million in the year 2021, thus showing a definite increase since last year. India, being a major buyer of Iranian crude oil, petroleum products imported by India from Iran estimated a total worth of around $175 million. The other exported products included dye intermediates worth $152 million, fresh fruit $148 million, and residual chemicals including allied products worth $40 million. Iran and India bilateral trade during the fiscal year 2022 rose to $2.5 billion from $1.693 billion in 2021, showing a 48% rise. On the other hand, India's exports to Iran have also shown a considerable increase. During January-December 2022, India's exports to Iran rose 44% to stand at $1.847 billion, while the figure was $1.284 billion in 2021. Rice has been Iran's major import from India during the year 2022. India has shipped $1.098 billion worth of basmati rice to Iran.
The other exports from the South Asian country include tea worth $79 million, sugar worth $66 million, other types of rice worth $61 million, and organic chemicals worth $44 million.
India has a pivotal role to play in Iran's economic ambitions, paving a way for it to increase its power beyond its immediate neighbors and improve its financial dynamics. For New Delhi, Tehran is a cheap and important source of oil and also provides road to reach the vast Central Asian markets. According to experts, the Islamic Republic of Iran holds strategic importance for the country of India. However, the current ties are primarily governed by economic interests.
New Delhi and Tehran have converging interests in trade and connectivity. India and Iran have also been trying to diversify their channels of payment to increase bilateral trade. According to the Iranian Foreign Ministry, the two sides are preparing a roadmap for strategic cooperation between Iran and India that can help regulate long-term relations and protect from the impact of destructive factors. As regards in India's imports from Iran, mineral fuels and oils dominate the import basket, accounting for as much as 90% of India's total imports from Iran. However, according to experts, both Iran and India are interested in developing economic and trade relations beyond energy and petrochemical products. Complementarity between New Delhi and Tehran's economies provides a base for exploring non-oil areas, including goods and services, investment, tourism, education, handicrafts, etc. This, according to international affairs analysts, will pave the way for strengthening the economic relations between the two countries furthermore. The countries have been also trying to diversify the channels of payment to expand the already existing mechanism to cover more goods and services, including all of the non-petroleum products.
Now, to have more insights on this, we are joined by Mr. Paul Cochran, an independent financial journalist from South Africa. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Iran's annual exports to India have risen considerably, reaching up to 60%. So how do you see the strengthening economic ties between the two countries in the context of the present world situation?
Over the past year between India and Iran, but it's still just 10%. Of what it was in 2019, when it was about $17 billion. And that stopped because of US pressure after Trump, President Trump, pulled out of the nuclear deal. I mean, at that time, Iran was supplying around 10% of India's oil needs. And that trade could easily bounce back to those sort of figures. But that's very much dependent on if the conditions become more favorable, such as India being allowed by the U.S. to import more Iranian oil. And from what we're seeing, the U.S. isn't going to budge on this at all. But there's a lot of things happening, obviously, you know, globally, geopolitically, that could change things. And it makes utter sense, I mean, for India and Iran to strengthen economic ties, particularly given the geographic proximity. I mean, particularly since the COVID pandemic, more and more countries are diversifying their sourcing of goods and products, as well as nearshoring. So nearshoring is buying goods and getting goods from closer to home to not have these problems like happened during the height of COVID on getting products from one side of the world to your place. So you want to get them closer together. But again, it's the ongoing issue, the ongoing saga of the sanctions and preventing increasing ties and getting those figures back up to what they were back in 2019 of $17 billion plus.
Mr. Cochran, apart from oil trade, the two countries have conducted business in non-oil products as well. And now, don't you think more areas beyond energy and petrochemicals could be explored?
There's a lot of areas where there could be a lot more cooperation and more business and trade. After oil, it's primarily fertilizers that India wants from Iran, but also fruits and vegetables and vice versa. And Iran wants Indian rice and needs it and wants more of that as well as tea. These are big business ties. There's lots of money going involved with this. But the problem is, though, in many senses, that there's not a huge amount yet that either side can sort of offer each other in terms of services or technology. But there are definitely areas which there could be more cooperation or more sales. The car market, for instance, is a potential one. Both India and Iran have their own car industries. They have sizable industries, and they could increase sales to each other on those fronts. But it's technology as well is a big area that India is doing well in, and its economy is growing across the board on so many levels. India could be a very big player in terms of more investment in Iran. But as with everything else, always it's still the issue of the sanctions. And if India is given a bit more maneuverability to be able to increase this trade, doing the barter deals works to a level, but there needs to always be enough rupees in Iranian banks and vice versa for allowing this trade to happen because of the sanctions on being able to do trade in US dollars in particular, but also euros.
So you've mentioned sanctions and payments. Now, both countries are searching for options to diversify payment channels. So what can be a viable option helping India and Iran build long-term economic relations immune to third country interference?
Well, this is the multi-billion dollar question, as it has been for years, how to be able to work around the sanctions and also how to be able to enable the payments to flow. Lots of options have been looked at. Some have even been tried. None seem to be that successful so far, primarily because the Western financial system is still so dominant and is proving very resilient to change. But given the sort of ongoing decoupling in many ways from the Western financial system, by certain countries wanting to push that, particularly Russia, but also China, we also saw at the end of last year, the floating of a new global reserve currency through the BRICS countries. This could push things forward. And if more countries also shift away from paying for oil in dollars, as Iran has done, but we've also seen that now with Russia, of course. And if this grows bigger and bigger, this will allow more options and more viability for some of those things to happen. And that would be ultimately beneficial to Iran and India. But still, you know, the dominant financial system is still there. The sanctions are there. Everyone's very scared of falling foul of the US Treasury. They're scared of falling foul of the sanctions. You know, look what happened in 2019 with so many countries that had invested in Iran had to pull out. You also had many countries that were allowed to deal with Iran after the nuclear deal, the JCPOA agreement, but they did not over concerns and the risks of being fined by the United States.
Last but not least, sir, India is aspiring to become a global economic power and the country needs to have a reliable source of energy, therefore requiring Iran to fulfill its expansive energy needs. So how do you see the relations between the two countries further evolving in this context?
The relations between India and Iran have been getting better and have been getting stronger. We've seen that over cooperation in Afghanistan. And we're also seeing that not directly, but through more connections, particularly between China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is also bringing in India and Iran through the International North-South Transport Corridor. That's going to be connecting India, Iran, Afghanistan, Russia, Central Asia, and Europe. And as this progresses and develops, that is going to be a big source of economic development and more trade. And the movements of goods within that immediate area, this is a big benefit. But India is really having to try and walk a tightrope between pleasing the Americans on one hand and needing cheap energy on the other for its economic needs. I mean, its economy is growing very fast. It's obviously a huge country. It's going to nearly be the largest populace on the planet. So it needs as much cheap energy as it possibly can. Which is where Iran played such a central role. I mean, back before 2019, providing 10% of India's oil needs is huge. And that needs to sort of come up there again for them to be able to have this a reliable and cheap source of energy. But India's obviously come under a lot of pressure over the past year for buying Russian oil. And so it's going to have to really be careful in how it considers buying and getting more Iranian oil, despite that it making utter sense on a geographic and economic level.
There you have it, Mr. Paul Cochrane, independent financial journalist from South Africa. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Samri Backup tweeted, Iran-India trade hit $2.5 billion in 2022, a 48% rise in comparison to 2021 when the figure stood at $1.693 billion. Rice was India's main export item to Iran, while oil was Iran's main export to India. Ross wrote, it's already happening. Russia is developing economic and military ties to China, India, and Iran, developing economic ties to Saudi Arabia. These countries will no longer be using dollars to purchase oil. NATO and the EU are in chaos. Louis B. wrote, the only economy that got worse was Europe and U.S. With good trade partners like China and India and Iran, Russia is doing better than Europe and U.S.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Last week, two Pakistani nationals were released from U.S. custody at the infamous Guantanamo Bay military prison facility after spending more than 20 years in imprisonment without any charges proven against them. The two brothers, Abdul Rabbani and Muhammad Rabbani, had been arrested in Karachi in 2002 and tortured in CIA custody before being taken to Guantanamo. They are the latest inmates to be freed from American custody as the government claims to be working on emptying and closing the infamous prison.
The brothers Abdul Rahim Ghulam Rabbani, 55, and Muhammad Ahmad Ghulam Rabbani, 53, were arrested from Karachi in September 2002 by Pakistani security forces and handed over to the U.S. authorities. They were held at a CIA detention center in Afghanistan for almost 2 years before being transferred to Guantanamo. U.S. authorities had accused the two of providing some al-Qaeda members with housing, travel, and other support. According to sources, Ahmad Rabbani frequently went on hunger strikes and would be force-fed through a tube. U.S. military records describe the two brothers as providing little intelligence of value statements during the interrogations that were obtained on the ground of physical abuse. Mushtaq Ahmad Khan, the chairman of the Human Rights Committee in the upper house of Pakistan's parliament, stated that the duo was innocent but were detained without trial or access to any judicial help by the U.S. government, thus violating the international human rights conventions. The departure of the two brothers has reduced the detainee population at Guantanamo Bay to 32 men, all sent there during the years of the George W. Bush administration. During its war on terror, the United States has held about 780 detainees at the notorious prison complex.
Guantanamo Bay has been the center of controversy for unlawful detention, denial of judicial process, physical and psychological abuse, torture, and gross violation of human rights. The case of the Rabbani brothers highlights the human rights violations conducted by the U.S. government at different prison facilities. The indefinite detention of prisoners without charge or trial is a violation of international human rights laws that the United States has been disregarding over the years.
Established by the Bush administration in 2002, Guantanamo Bay Military Prison Facility has been used as a detention camp for foreign terrorism suspects. The prison became functional after the September 11th attacks in New York that led to the cry of war on terror by the U.S. Over the past 20 years, more than 700 prisoners, all Muslims, have been detained at the ill-famed prison. During the peak years of war on terror, the facility held over 600 people accused of terrorism by the U.S. authorities. 20 years later, 32 inmates remain at the military detention center. According to the Pentagon, 18 have been cleared for transfer if stable third-party countries are willing to take them. The Guantanamo Bay facility has been indelibly marked with accusations of human rights violations and has drawn criticism for its indefinite detention without a trial policy. The U.S. government has long defended its indefinite detention policy at Guantanamo, claiming that such measures are necessary to protect national security. However, human rights groups have argued that these actions are illegal and have called for an end to the practice of indefinite detention. As per international law experts, the full reckoning of harms caused by the disastrous war on terror can only begin when Guantanamo is closed for good.
Now, to have more insights on this, we are joined by Mr. Ken O'Keefe, geopolitical analyst from Liverpool, England. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, in another instance of gross human rights violations committed by the U.S., two innocent Pakistani nationals were held for 20 years in Guantanamo prison without any proven charges. Now, has the international community failed to stand for the innocents suffering without trial in the U.S. prisons?
I don't think that there can be any serious question as to whether or not the obligations of the international community, in particular the bodies that deal with violations of international law, are being violated. And while the crimes are being committed, there are no prosecutions. And if we look at, say, the International Criminal Court, we see that African nations have been targeted, but I don't see one conviction, not one, not even any prosecution, of American war criminals for all of the various tortures, genocides, war of aggression, crimes against humanity, use of depleted uranium, experimental weapons. All of these things have been used in a place called Iraq, which I've been to as a Marine. So I've seen it with my own eyes. And it's ironic because those of us who believe in law realize that we must affect real and genuine lawful remedy. Because if we don't have lawful remedy, what alternative do we have? Violence. And we're leading towards World War III already with what's happening in Ukraine. So it really is time for people to take responsibility and understand that these bodies not doing their job is a reflection of us as people not doing our job. And if we do everything we're capable of, we will affect a lawful remedy process that will make convictions. And you know what? I only want the law. But law is brutal when it comes to committing the worst of crimes.
Mr. O'Keefe, the United States argues its human rights obligations are under international law. However, the truth shows otherwise. So the question is, why do these evident violations remain unpunished?
In order to understand how the world functions, it really is critical, and I've been saying this now for decades, and I stand by the position. In order to understand the way the world works, we really have to understand the nature of money and how it's produced and who has the money and how do they use that money and how much money do the rest of us have. If we look at the trail of money, we find that the bankers benefit profoundly from war. They also benefit from social strife and injustice. They benefit from debt, which is foisted upon the populations of the world. They are the ones that are pulling the strings. And unfortunately, we have not done what is necessary, and therefore it is absolutely essential that we recognize that our leaderships have failed us across the board. There are some exceptions, and ironically, I've just returned from Iran, and you know, I see more benefits in the society of Iran than I do in my own birth nation, which is literally taking a path towards Satan on multiple levels.
Sir, do you think any inquiry will be conducted anytime soon to look into these crimes?
You know, it really is important that what gets lost in the numbers and statistics is the people. We talked about earlier the Pakistani prisoners from Guantanamo who spent over two decades in there. It's not even just the victims of these types of things and what impact it has. I've been in a prison myself, one of the most notorious prisons in the world, and I've experienced torture firsthand myself. So I understand what this does to the average person and how difficult it is just on an individual level. But what about the families? You know, all of these people, these prisoners that are held without any due process of law, literally oftentimes incognito in places like Guantanamo, no access to your family, attorneys, representation, and no basic needs as even a prisoner. These things add up, and it creates a lot of pain for people that requires healing. And in order to affect healing, there's only one way, and that is through justice. How can you heal from a crime if there is never any justice? The only way then is through God, and God will take care of God's part. We need to take care of the part down here on planet Earth. And affecting the law and lawful remedy is, I stand by it. This has got to be the way. So where we have improvements and necessary changes with regard to the law, let's do so. Let's hold our leaders to account. Let's stop shifting the blame to our leaders who are corrupt when we have to accept the fact that we're responsible for them.
Last but not least, Mr. O'Keefe, you've mentioned getting away with it. It's clear to the international community that there were and continue to be violations of human rights norms at different U.S. prisons, but there has been little done about it. So why has the international community failed in enforcing the law against the war crimes of the U.S.?
There are several layers of protection for the United States, which effectively provides immunity to it. In particular, the international laws governing the worst of crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, torture, genocide, things of this nature. The International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice are not doing their job. And they're able to get away with not doing their job by shifting the blame to other parties, such as rarely the United States and even less so Israel. These bodies shift the blame, so nobody takes responsibility and no prosecutions occur. But again, I did mention earlier, African convictions have occurred at the International Criminal Court. What, is Africa